Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 8th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. In the last couple of weeks, Lyndon LaRouche has made a special point of emphasis that in going after President Obama for his impeachable crimes, we have to go beyond the personality of Obama and recognize that he's a tool, a puppet, in the hands of a much more powerful global force. And LaRouche has been insisting that we have to go at the cause of the problem. And that cause is the British Empire and its policy of genocide against six-sevenths of the human race. And we've documented, both on the LaRouchePack.com website and also in the EIR, that crimes against humanity are being committed. There's no question about that, whether it's in the war that's going on in the Middle East that's continuing to expand, whether it's the deployment of a global Anglo-Saudi terror operation, whether it's the Obamacare policy, which is modeled on the Nazis and their euthanasia program, or on the spying, the police state spying, which we've had one new scandal a week practically. When you look at these things, what you have to realize is that there's a network responsible for these crimes. And this is the extended, integrated, financial and related cartels, which are directed from the City of London. And there's also an intent, and the intent is a dramatic reduction of the world's population, including in the United States. And there are two things that we really have to do that LaRouche has been emphasizing on this. First, he says we have to get people to understand that it's not just Obama, but it's the policy, it's the commitment to genocide of this network. But secondly, also, we have to get people to realize there's a solution, that the return to the American system, starting with Glass-Steagall, and including the Glass-Steagall Plus, as some of us call it, which includes NOWAPA as the major driver for infrastructure development, and also a credit system to be able to fund that. Now, we're very fortunate to have on the program today someone who has been writing about this for many, many years, starting from the publication of a critical book, The Political Economy of the American Revolution, which I believe came out in 1975.
77,
okay. So, 2 years after all these years, what's the difference there? So our guest today, who you just heard from, is Nancy Spanis, who's the longtime editor of the Executive Intelligence Review. And Nancy has distinguished herself over the years in her writings on the American Revolution, the American system, Alexander Hamilton, the Founding Fathers, but also through her position as editor in the EIR, has repeatedly produced updated reports on the House of Windsor and the predecessors to the House of Windsor, going back to William of Orange. So I'm expecting that what we're going to be discussing today will give you, the listener, who is also not just a listener, but a bunch of activists who are out mobilizing and organizing, give you more ammunition from the standpoint of how do you communicate to people the nature of the enemy, and also how to beat them. So, Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Harley.
Now, you were just in a discussion with Mr. LaRouche, and what I've liked to do recently when possible, when having guests who have been at these discussions, just begin by what you think is most relevant for the topic we'll be discussing today from Mr. LaRouche's comments.
Well, the primary thrust that he was focused on today was an elaboration of the forecasting idea that he presented in the webcast last night. You may recall, and he also said this is one of his major concerns about the way we're approaching the situation, that we cannot look at what is happening as a trend. We must look at the underlying potential trend that we have to bring into being, and that this is the approach that he has always taken in his successful forecasts and it's the approach that we have to take now. And any time that we get into the state of mind of deduction or induction, in fact, rather than the creative use of the flank to create the kind of future that mankind must have, we are going to run into trouble and be defeated. And we have to not only ensure that we have that state of mind ourselves, but we have to be able to figure out how to outflank the people who are either too terrified or too stupid to use their own creative imagination.
So there are two flanks then. We have to outflank the enemy, which generally is not that clever, but certainly is persistent.
Yes.
But we also have to outflank the population, which seems to be gullible, naive, pessimistic, and falls into both illusion and also fear.
Yes, they just don't want to see the reality of the situation, both from the standpoint of what the major power is that is manipulating what is going on in front of them, but also the fact that they themselves have fallen into the being manipulated and have to change their own state of mind in order to be able to deal with it. Mr. LaRouche was very much focused again on this concept of the chorus versus the action in both drama and also in musical composition, referencing going back in drama to, for example, the Greek classical dramas, and in the musical realm, particularly to Bach and the Passions, where the chorus plays a particular role of reflecting on what the action is in order to bring people to a higher state of mind. And a very interesting point was brought up relevant to the organizing around the Glass-Steagall approach. If people heard the webcast last night, the third question was a recounting of some problems that organizers ran into mm-hmm. with congressmen or aides. You may recall this, you know,
sure.
People being thrown out of offices and so forth because they wouldn't succumb to the idea that Dodd-Frank has to be given a chance or some ridiculous idea like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the way that Mr. LaRouche answered that question didn't do at all what he was asked to do, which was, or it did, but in a way surprising to everybody, which is, because he was asked to put himself in the position of the organizer, and what he did was do that by going back to the process which has brought people in Congress to saying stupid things that defend Wall Street. Why would anybody in the state of the economy right now why would anybody come forward to defend Wall Street and say, give them a chance? The same guys who have created this mess are now creating another one. We have another housing bubble. We have another asset bubble. Everybody knows it. They're doing exactly the same thing. And it's going to have even more genocidal results when it blows out and is having those genocidal results by destroying the productive capacity of our agriculture, of our infrastructure, of our labor force.
Isn't this the same problem that you see when you see Democrats who were somewhat forceful in opposing George W. Bush's police state measures with the Patriot Act and wiretapping and so on, who are now defending the Obama administration, which has gone far beyond Bush?
It's absolutely wild. It is the case that Obama has used the Bush-Cheney police state measures as a platform to expand them. And that was intended by the British Empire, which, I mean, let's use this as another case in point. in terms of where the author of this comes. Where does this recent, and I say recent, it's been 12 years, 13 years now, where does this recent process of police state consolidation come from? Perhaps many of our listeners think it's been there forever or something like that because they feel like little people. But it wasn't there forever. There was a shock administered to the United States with the intention of creating a fascist dictatorship and destroying the United States' ability to reverse a global fascist financial dictatorship. And that shock was 9/11. It was administered through the collaboration between the British monarchy and the Saudi monarchy with accomplices here in the United States. And the immediate intent was to have a fascist dictatorship here. At that point, despite the fact that we had been going down in terms of courage and mental acuity over decades, the Congress objected. They didn't allow the immediate authorization of the use of military force to say we could attack everywhere. Now, of course, Obama's ignored that, and he's attacking everywhere. And they also did not allow the total blanket surveillance and plus, I mean, and you have to say surveillance plus, because we don't know that.
But what we do know from the last couple of days is that not only were, at least with Verizon, but probably other carriers, there's been a data mining or metadata operation underway. But also, wasn't there a release yesterday on the internet that Google, Yahoo, Skype, all these entities were also being monitored by the NSA?
Oh, absolutely. Now that, if you believe Obama, is just for foreign conversations, but that's not the case. And this is precisely what was in process and objected to, the use of the internet providers. Was what was became an issue under the Bush administration, and there was a big fight about it. But ultimately, the issue was the following: some of these guys at least pretended to object, but unless they got immunity in the law, well, eventually they did get the immunity in the law that was passed in the summer, early summer, of 2008. After a big fight, and guess who decided to vote for that immunity? Barack Obama.
When he was in the Senate.
When he was in the Senate, when he was campaigning as a great liberal against Hillary Clinton for the nomination for president. We are told from fairly reliable, there seems to be reliable agreement, this is not a personal backroom discussion, but there seems to be fair agreement that the person who convinced him to do that was John Brennan, now head of the CIA, because he was the counterterrorism advisor to Obama in his political campaign. So he was showing his colors, you know, and we had already exposed him as more British than anybody else on the scene at the time, but that he was going to move in this direction. But you got to look at what is happening to the United States and why people became fearful to the 9/11 process.
Well, what I'd like to do, Nancy, is come back to that from the standpoint of what it is that most Americans don't know about the British Empire, because I know from the radio programs I do and the organizing that I do that you always get a certain kind of strange look at you when you first bring up the power of the Queen and the British monarchy and the British Empire. And this is something that you've documented from American history, and I'd like to just start by what I think is highly relevant for the Obama case, which is the difference between the American system and the British system as economic financial systems.
Okay. Well, I'm on sort of a hobby horse on how to efficiently present that.
Well, then we got you at the right time.
Okay, which is, and I don't know how many times this has been done on your program, but I think it's one of the most efficient things, which is to go to Henry Carey.
Go ahead. That's critical.
Okay. Now, Henry Carey, just for any people who don't know, was the son of Matthew Carey, an Irishman who was recruited by Benjamin Franklin and was part of the early, you know, in the 1790s, was here in the United States working for the consolidation of the Republic. And he understood that the economic ideas of Alexander Hamilton, which were based upon establishing national sovereignty through the development of the productive powers of labor, tariffs, infrastructure building, and national banking, were critical. He didn't like some of the other policies of the Federalist Party, which Hamilton was part of. So he worked with the Jeffersonians as well, but then he was responsible for pulling together in the late 18-teens the best from both traditions, Hamilton and a more democratic, with a small d, traditions. And, you know, that was the basis, that agreement of nation building around Hamiltonian principles was the basis for the administrations of, for the most part, of Monroe, and John Quincy Adams, which were the most productive administrations in our early history. So his son became the economist for Abraham Lincoln, and he wrote extensively and had big international influence as well on the two systems of American versus British system.
He was one of the people who called it the American system.
Absolutely. Well, so Hamilton did also. There's actually a reference to it in the Federalist Papers. There was also discussion of it in from others, but
Hamilton was pretty well aware of what one of the things Lynn keeps talking about, which is the policy in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Hamilton was recruited from the West Indies by networks of people who were very familiar with that. They lived in New Jersey for the most part, but then he did collaborate through in Philadelphia and other places with the networks around Franklin. And Franklin, of course, was the legacy of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. That,
yeah.
He was the transmission belt to a great degree. Plus, Hamilton was heavily influenced by the Colbert tradition in France.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the track of a little bit more of that in the coming period. One of the leading economic writers under Colbert was someone he studied a great deal, someone named Savary. But I haven't read his work, so I can't say a lot about that. But the American system has always been a matter of a fight within the United States. And Carey was very heavily involved in that, because obviously by the time he was around, which is, we're talking about something that I'm going to read to you, written in 1851, there had been a tremendous progress made by the British bankers who came in with Andrew Jackson, with the huge revival of the slave trade, huge revival of the slave system, destruction of free trade, and attempt to really recolonize the United States. So Carey was involved in trying to outflank this both in the United States by educating people and also internationally, you know, by recruiting pushing American system ideas around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote this piece called Harmony of Interest, which was published it was a pamphlet, 1851, largely for circulation in the South and West. And the last article has a whole section called, which is devoted to Two Systems Are Before the World. And the paragraph is very long and intimidating, so I'm going to just read the end of it because I think it's very to the point. And you have to keep this in mind all the time, because right now, any idea that anyone has in the United States of economics usually has nothing to do with the American system. You know, the whole idea of, you know, we compete better, forget it. That's Adam Smith. The whole idea of cheap labor, you know, that's Adam Smith.
Which is, of course, the hallmark now of the regimes of people like Chris Christie and the governors of Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin.
Everybody, efficiency of government, you know, freedom of the individual and so forth. So let's, Two Systems Before the World. I'm going to start in the middle or near the end. One system looks to increasing the necessity for progress for commerce, the other to increasing the power to maintain it. One looks to underworking the Hindu and sinking the rest of the world to his level. The other to raising the standard of man throughout the world to our level. One looks to pauperism, ignorance, depopulation, and barbarism. The other to increasing wealth, comfort, intelligence, combination of action, and civilization. One looks toward universal war, the other toward universal peace. One is the English system, the other we may be proud to call the American system, for it is the only one ever devised, the tendency of which was that of elevating while equalizing the condition of man throughout the world. Such is the true mission of the people of these United States. I think that's a beautiful summary because it really takes in many of the things that have really been lost from our culture. The idea, and we're very live to the people who were fighting the American Revolution, this idea of elevating man, elevating him in his standard of living, elevating him in education, elevating him in his human dignity, of the cooperation between man, of economic development being an alternative to war, the whole, you know, Kerry was attacking Malthusianism at the time, the whole green.
Yeah, it has depopulation
idea.
In
yeah,
there.
It has depopulation.
But of course,
in there.
That was around the time of the Irish famine, wasn't it?
1851, absolutely it was.
Where the British were deliberately starving the Irish.
Right. So the what was understood then is very much, now he's an intellectual, right? I'm not saying everybody who read a newspaper understood everything that he had to say, but people did read newspapers then. That was good. And newspapers had a lot more substance than they have today. But what you're, you have to go to, as you indicate, first principles, and the and I think this is a pretty good indication there. The British financial empire is not British, of course. It was created starting at least in Rome, right? Then moving north to Venice, then moving north to the Low Countries, the Dutch, which Lynn has been emphasizing a great deal, and then moving to England. But they didn't really totally move. They're all intermarried, right? Anytime you go to some see a royal wedding or a royal affair in Europe, you see them all there, you know, even the
you saw Greek. There was just a wedding of the Princess of Sweden with a banker who is Wall Street and City of London.
Well, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
They're just incestuous crowd by design. And so you're dealing with a combined oligarchy whose center of operation has been London, the city of London in particular, which is not London, but a particular section of the city with all the financial institutions in it. The Queen is the Empress of the crowd. She's the top dog, right? But you know, I raised with Lyndon LaRouche recently. I said, well, people are saying she's sick, you know, and she's giving up some of her functions to her son. God help us. You know, what when she dies? And he said, well, they'll appoint somebody else. This is an institution. It's not just like Obama's not just an individual. You know, the empire is not just the personalities. But her position is primus inter pares, or the first among so-called equals of an oligarchy. And the control is waged in many ways. It's very still extremely strong in physical cartels. I mean, the British basically run and control the Gulf cartels, which are the oil cartels, the mineral cartels like Rio Tinto Zinc, grain cartels. These things you can see people on their boards from the top of the City of London financial institutions.
Well, and this is where Lynn often talks about the Venetian model, which if you look at finance, insurance, again, as cartels, you see that this is really not based in any country, and that this is, in fact, part of the reason they're opposed to any idea of national sovereignty.
Absolutely. You know, this is what took over. This is why we make such a big deal about 1971 with taking the dollar off gold. It's not that we have a fetish about gold. is the fact that currencies were being delinked from countries. And no longer were you going to have a relationship between currencies and the physical economy of the countries, which, you know, is your only viable basis for an international financial system. So, but I think the best way that, so you've got physical cartels, you have the spawning of and nurturing of terrorist movements, which are related to that oil cartel in ways that I'm not going to go through in detail, but you get from the Steinberg work and so forth. You also have that as the center patronage of the green movement, of the environmentalist movement, which, you know, has been going on for more than a century.
It was given a big coordinating boost by Prince Philip himself with the founding of the World Wildlife Fund.
Yeah, although, which is 1961, but it was going before that, you know, very heavily with the eugenics movement and so forth back into the 19th century. So, but I think the best way people can have to understand the control aspect of this is if you think about. And what helps me understand it, right, without having to know an infinite number of names, faces, and connectos, is how much you realize that the markets, so-called, control what people are able and willing to do, right? What does the market say is feasible now? And if you realize that idea of the markets is these small set of global financial institutions that determine who gets insurance, that determine what the interest rates are going to be. Remember LIBOR. That's the London Interbank something rate, right? That was set in London, right? People understand that the markets, right, that high finance controls their lives.
Well, and when you're talking about this, to go back to what Carey was talking about, Henry Carey, and also the whole question of the American versus the British system, when you talk about modern economics, you're talking about a financial system, a money system, as opposed to what we did in the United States as a physical economy.
Right, right. So, I mean, Hamilton, the American system was, what was the market, so-called, at the time of the American Revolution? That then it was explicitly the British Empire, right? And the East India Company and associated cartels of that day. At that point, they understood, the founding fathers, Franklin, Hamilton, Washington, that if you submitted to that, you were submitting to a system of slavery. And they could see that, right? We just got more evidence brought to light recently. It'll be in the next issue of the EIR, of how the fact that the British were carrying out policies leading to mass famine, I mean, this is the killing of millions in India, in 1767, this was being under the tutelage of the British East India Company, you know, for their economic reasons, right? This was well publicized in the United States in the early 1770s. And therefore, when people said that if the British Empire is able to dictate to us in the United States, in the colonies, in the American colonies, what our economic policy is going to be, and the British Empire had been cutting back increasingly what they would permit the colonies to do, including, you know, the Iron Act and the restricting the expansion of territory, mm-hmm. and restricting the ability to print currency and so forth. All these things had been, the shrinking of power over their own self-development had been increasingly been imposed, certainly from the 1750s forward. The people realized that a future like that in India, with mass famine, because the Indians had to produce for the market, i.e. the East India Company, and couldn't take care of themselves, was their future.
Well, I think we can say, as we have been, that that's the American people's immediate future if we don't defeat this empire. This is the LaRouche Show. You're listening to Nancy Spanis, the editor of Executive Intelligence Review, and we're discussing this question of the British Empire today and how to defeat them. Now, one of the problems we run up against in the organizing, Nancy, is that most Americans, now maybe I'm taking a leap of faith here, but I think most Americans realize we fought the British in the American Revolution. And many know of the War of 1812, but after that...
Have you ever been to Yorktown, Harley? I was at Yorktown when I was running for office, and unfortunately... The 200th anniversary of Yorktown, was it 200? Yeah, happened under the tutelage of Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. They celebrated it down there.
Yeah.
And what they did is they have a little plaque to the eternal friendship between England and
the United
States. Well,
this is what I was just going to get to, because one of the reasons that LaRouche is correctly pointing out that the Americans have been blinded to a foreign power essentially taking over our institutions of government is precisely because there's a vague sense of history that we once may have opposed the British, but the 20th century was a century of American-British friendship. They've rewritten the whole period of Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, which we fortunately resurrected the true history with our 1932 video, which is still available on the LaRouche Pack website. But I would argue that one of the biggest problems has been the 20th century, where the United States has had two presidents assassinated, both of whom were anti-British. And it's a century where we've had a number of traitors who were openly pro-British, at least in their thinking, in the case of Wilson, certainly in the case of Obama. How do you communicate to people, how do you get people to start looking at this real history to understand what the crisis is today?
Well, there's the question of the history, but then there's the question of the smell, I would say. Because the fact is that everything comes down to what is the concept of the nature of man. And the British imperial system has a concept of man as an animal, a servant, a serf, a lump, basically, that gets excited by some things and upset by other things, but is not part of a unified culture that is producing a better future. It's abiding by tradition. I mean, after all, and when people defend the monarchy, why do they ha on what basis do they defend the monarchy? It's our tradition, right? They pretend it has no power over them, which is not true, but they say, well, we have to love it because it's our tradition. Versus an idea of man who is committed to improvement of the himself and the human race, both morally and physically, and developing a system of government and credit and a belief in the future that will actually produce a better future for future generations. It's a unique characteristic of the U.S. Constitution, as far as I know. I've sometimes wanted to have a project of reading a lot of other constitutions. I haven't actually done it. So I have to take the word for it from some of my knowledgeable friends. But that the United States Constitution is basically the only one that that number one has a concise statement of principle to begin with and is committed to the future. We're doing the following these principles. It's not a Bill of Rights. It's a statement of principle on which of goals and commitments for a future society, our posterity. And if you don't smell the difference between a system and individuals who are committed to that kind of future, and willing to put the resources of the nation behind that kind of progress for the individual and for the nation, as opposed to one which is committed to keeping people happy today with their traditions, no matter how miserable their life is in physical and moral terms, then you have a real difficulty really getting at the gut of the matter. I think one thing also, I mean, thinking of what the resources we have available on the LaRouche Pack site that is very useful is these Kennedy speeches on the NWAPA and the dams. I mean, he's not talking about NWAPA, but he's talking about water management, about what these and the space question and the physical infrastructure question and what he's talking about our commitment as a nation to be. Those kind of speeches, you probably heard something like that in the immediate post-colonial period of some third world countries, right? When they were attempting to come out of total abject servitude to the Dutch Empire or the French Empire or the British Empire. But I would dare say that the inspiration for many of them making those kind of speeches with that kind of dedication to investing in the future of their population was inspired or directly affected by the United States.
We were just discussing that this morning. I was on a radio show, an African American radio show in Columbus, Ohio, and the question came up of the background of Susan Rice, who is supposedly a figure who cut her teeth fighting genocide. And it's precisely the opposite. She's been promoting genocide, and in this case in particular, you brought up Africa. She was a staunch defender of the genocide conducted by Museveni of Uganda and Kagame of Rwanda. And for what purpose? I mean, it's the same issue. It's a neo-colonial policy of raw materials and weakening any country that does not submit to the International Monetary Fund and the global cartels.
Right, right. And believe me, it's well known in Africa that is her outlook. We had a demonstration in New York City in the UN area not, you know, some number of months ago outside an embassy. And every African that, it was an African embassy, I'm not supposed to say who it was, but everybody who came out, you know, was enraged at Susan Rice because they know that she doesn't represent any kind of hope for the future of Africa. It's not only promoting certain dictators who carry out these atrocities, but the stymieing of the whole place through a lack of support for building the physical infrastructure and the increased living standard that is required, which is something that Kennedy did, for example. It's another whole area. It's what FDR did when he went down to South America. You know, he represented that, and what he did with the TVA without even going places, where the TVA was a model for the entire third world, as the kind of way that you pull people out of poverty with government infrastructure building. And that is, and, you know, that's just a commitment that is evident in the physical activity and growth and enormous transformation of the landscape that occurred in that area.
Well, let's get to the immediate political battle then. We've put out a couple of publications in the past on the coming fall of the House of Windsor, and it seems to me that the only thing that's been propping up the House of Windsor is their control over the United States and increasingly over continental Europe. How is it that, Lynn keeps emphasizing Glass-Steagall is a weapon that would pretty much destroy this empire, and that's why they're so focused on it. How does Glass-Steagall function in that kind of empire-deflating way?
Well, it is indeed the case that without the United States, this international financial blob that's very much centered in the monarchy and the city of London does not have power. That's the case both financially, but it's also the case militarily, even more starkly, right? Because the war aims of that monarchy, which are really aims to destroy national sovereignty in the entire world, with the high risk of and willingness to potentially detonate a thermonuclear war that would wipe out population dramatically, perhaps all of it, is, besides that, that absolutely depends on the United States, because only the United States has the physical armament and capability to confront Russia and China. Britain can't do it on its own. Britain couldn't even carry out the operation in Libya without the United States. So they depend, that destructive power on the part of the empire depends on their control of the United States, and Obama is particularly controlled, although Bush was also under control. There was more opposition to Bush in the United States than there has been to Obama. But on the financial side, the question is, the empire exercises power through, I presented it as the markets, but part of that idea of the markets is the massive debt, which is created through gambling, derivatives, and, you know, an endless number of acronyms that I couldn't possibly exhaust. So, of different kinds of financial instruments. These are instruments of slavery because they are simply so-called values that give these financial entities power over people's lives, and they've used those to strip the physical economy and conditions of life and the productive powers of labor to the point that we no longer, as a world, produce sufficient to support the current population of the world, much less a growing population of the world. So what we need to do is destroy the power of those markets which now prevent people from investing, from supporting people, you know, in their immediate needs, and also investing in the kind of physical infrastructure and future production which are required to support them. They say, we can't afford it, we can't afford it, we can't afford it, but we have to pay this debt, but we have to pay, you know, meet these conditions of these financial authorities because, you know, they have power of life or death over us.
And what we've seen is that, in fact, the policies dictated from the City of London through the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, and the European Central Bank, those policies are killing people in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, with suicide rates up, hospitals shutting down.
You could make the case it's happened in the United States also, because the suicide rate has gone up dramatically for people over the age of 50, I think, is between 50 and 64 in particular, in the United States over the last decade or so, which, you know, is not simply explained, but is certainly related to the fact that this generation of people is looking at a very dismal future. No retirement funds, their children not being able to find jobs, and the horror of what is actually our conditions of life really are hopelessly in front of us. So what does Glass-Steagall do? Glass-Steagall is in a sense, a house-cleaning measure. Roosevelt did it in two steps. He did it with the bank holiday and then the Banking Act of 1933, which is what Glass-Steagall was. By the way, I suppose it's useful to mention that 1 week from tomorrow is the 80th anniversary of the signing of it, June 16th, 1933. And we're really pressing that point in Washington, D.C., because sometimes that helps us work our way into the consciousness of congressmen and senators because they like the idea of doing something on an anniversary. But anyway, Glass-Steagall cuts off support for the illegitimate gambling debt. That's what it does. It says no longer do we consider legitimate having deposit insurance for this kind of gambling debt, of having support from the federal government in any one of its other myriad programs of support, which you probably could rattle off better than I. But that's what Glass-Steagall actually does. It breaks the tie. So therefore, it, in effect, in a very short period of time, is going to wipe a whole lot of obligations off the books, put them on, you know, back on the people who created them, created those obligations, and they're going to go bankrupt because they aren't going to be able to cover them. So a lot of people are going to lose their job on Wall Street, lose their entity. And that's not bad, because if they stayed in motion, in operation, they're destroying us all. They're destroying both their own future and the economy of the nation. And if we get the economy of the nation back on a credit system where the money that is issued where the is becomes credit issued for actual productive activity, then we end up capable of redeeming whatever debt is nominally created by future productivity and progress in the society. That's the way we have to think about economy. We have to think that what we're doing with an issuance of credit from the federal government is creating future production and conditions of the labor force that will produce more at the end of a certain period of time than we put into it. That's progress. That's the way it was understood by Alexander Hamilton. That's the way it was understood by Lincoln, Kerry, and the other, and that's what was done by Roosevelt.
Let me get now to the question of Obama and whether or not he can be removed, whether there's a motion against him coming from certain networks in the establishment, as I think is clear if you look at the role that's being played by the Guardian. It's hardly a pro-American newspaper, and yet that was where the story of the Verizon scandal was leaked. At what point is the decision made to dump Obama, and is it going to require support from an alternative establishment proposal or a British proposal, or can we do it in the United States? Can the American people do it?
Well, I would certainly vote for the American people doing it, because and people have to look. The fundamental is, in my view, besides ripping open a little bit of the facade that has covered over what the government has actually been doing, this scandal has at least put Obama on the defensive. LaRouche says, he's weakened him. In that sense, he has been weakened. He's on the defensive. And that should, and palpably has, at least in the initial few days, embolden some people who otherwise we know to be opposed to Obama's policies, but have not had the guts to actually stand up and say something about it. So, and much less do anything about it. So you have begun to have some Democrats. I mean, look, the person who attacked Attorney General Holder in this hearing on Thursday, where the Verizon question came up, was Barbara Mikulski. Now, she's a top-level Democrat, very close to the administration, ostensibly, right? And when Holder came out with this line, which is the one of the major defenses of the administration on this whole outrageous dragnet of police state surveillance operation, and said, well, Congress approved it all. They know everything. Blame them. She said, I don't want to hear this. This is a lie. And since then, Senator Merkley said it was a lie, although he stopped short of saying it was a lie. He just said it wasn't true. Manchin said it was a lie. And it is a lie. I'm sure Wyden said it was a lie, and Udall and so forth, people who have wanted to talk, indicated they wanted to talk about this a lot more earlier. So he's been weakened. What does that mean? That means a couple things have to happen, and they will feed each other. The more each one goes forward, the one is moves toward impeachment of the president. Number two, get rid of his attorney general. I mean, this thing does not happen linearly necessarily at all. And the other thing is to press the policies that people have been afraid to press, such as Glass-Steagall, which is absolutely critical at the same time. This is, because we have a process of destruction and genocide going on the on an economic and financial basis that has to be stopped. We have to stop it before there's another huge blowout, and before more people are killed. So this process should feed both of that, but it's going to have to come from the population. It's going to have to come from art, not population. It has to come from leadership within the population, which is people listening to this program and associated with our organization, because every bit of progress we've made, as everyone knows, who knows anything, on the Glass-Steagall front has been from us.
I think it's also fair to say that it has to come from this top-down approach, which you've presented today, that you can't just have an accumulation of scandals against Obama, which suddenly add up to the point that someone's going to say, hey, it's time for him to go. People have to understand the actual intent of the people behind Obama and take seriously that their lives are at stake.
Right. They have to take that seriously, and they have to realize that there is an alternative that has functioned in American history in particular. You know, I haven't done a lot of pushing of the website on this particular program, but I know you push it every week. But we do have a lot of resources there that should help people. I mean,
well, also, Nancy, what about, I think the current issue of the Executive Intelligence Review takes up this question in the House of Windsor, doesn't it?
Last week's, yes. Last week. There's an article that was from a briefing from Jeffrey Steinberg that goes through the generally more in the, it goes through some of the aspects of what the empire actually controls at this point. Yes. And that's very useful. The House of Windsor report that we did, which has dated material but very indicative about the international cartels, is available in the store on the website. So there's just an enormous amount of material that people can use to get themselves in a armed, in a sense. But I think most critical, you can't trust the Congress, you know, yet.
Yeah, having the material available and having the truth available doesn't always translate into winning justice.
No. Well, and, you know, Congress has begun to, did erupt this week, you know, in the shock of the effect. But we have to be on their tail totally, because they will fall back. It's not clear at all that the Republican leadership will go in for the kill. They won't do it. I mean, and to do it, they have to also be pressed on what the actual solution is, because, you know, the British Empire could decide to dump Obama. The top people in the British Empire could decide that he's a liability and come in with somebody worse. LaRouche has actually said that recently. It could happen, unless there's a juggernaut, to use an old term that we often used, for the American system policy that is required, which leads with Glass-Steagall. And so people do have to educate themselves on what that policy is with the multitudinous ability. We just have finished, LaRouche Pack just reissued the program pamphlet. I don't know if that's been announced before, updated on the credit system, Glass-Steagall and NAWPA. It's extremely good and needs to be mastered. And people have to keep an eye on what the alternative is, knowing that it's genocide and dictatorship on the one hand, if we keep going with what we have, but that there is a prospect for a kind of progress that we haven't seen in decades, if we apply the principles that were applied under Roosevelt and earlier.
Well, the next few weeks, the Congress is in session.
Absolutely.
There's an opportunity to do something. We need to get more sponsors in the Senate. And to do that, it really does require a special kind of mobilization, not just in mass, but also institutional, getting farm leaders, getting business leaders, regional bankers, and so on.
And don't take any monetarist bullshit. I mean, that's what I would say. I mean, one point that was made today is that and that LaRouche made last night. When you get into a tit-for-tat argument with people about the measures in Dodd-Frank, you're losing. You've got to go to the issue of what this country is all about, what the future is all about, and people have better explained to you why they're willing to let our food supply be destroyed, why, you know, our space program be destroyed, our bridges fall down, and people die en masse out of from everything from suicide to mass violence to starvation, because they don't have the guts.
We're out of time, but that was the precise ending that we needed. It's in the hands of our networks and our supporters. And don't sit back now and watch what's going to happen. Make the change yourself. So, Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today. This has been another edition of The LaRouche Show, and we will be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, as always. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.